This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. We have a wonderful opportunity to be here this morning, and I hope we all realize how blessed we are to be able to be here. I want to thank everybody who's participated in helping us with this service this morning. Not everybody in this world can do it, so let's not take it for granted. If you'd like to go ahead and open up your Bibles to Ruth chapter 1. We're going to be starting a series, getting through the four chapters of Ruth, beginning this week. And I do a lot of topical studies, and I don't want to overlook the textual studies as well. Getting into the Bible and just looking at what God has to say in a specific area. I like the topical ones because they're very easy to make personal application with. But we can do that as well when we look at these textual sermons. Or studies, rather. And so, like I said, we're going to start with Ruth chapter 1 this morning. We're going to look and see what we can learn from these two ladies in particular. We're going to be looking at other characters as we get into other lessons. But let's go ahead and open up our Bibles and let's see what we can learn from Ruth chapter 1. If you want to begin reading with me in verse 1, we're going to read the first five verses as we set the stage for what we're going to learn here. It says there in verse 1, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, the other was Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years, rather. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband." Now, before we go any further with that, if you want to go ahead and turn over to Judges chapter 3, I want us to establish a little bit about, or remind ourselves, rather, about what's going on, the attitude and the heart of some of the people during this time. In Judges chapter 3 and verse 7, it says, "And the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and forgot the Lord their God, and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth." You can continue reading there through verse 15, and you see this cycle that we're all too familiar with the attitude of these people. They were good, then they started following other gods, and they started doing wickedness in the sight of the Lord. And so God raised up a nation to defeat them. And then He sent prophets to help deliver them. And so they became righteous again. But before you know it, they turned back to their evil ways, back to their gods, and God had to punish them again. And so this cycle happens all throughout the Judges. So that's what we see continuing through there. If you look over chapter 25, we can see the general principle that these people lived by. There in chapter 21, verse 25, the last verse of the book of Judges, you see this being said about them. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes." So God's people are not behaving as God's people. They're being very wicked at this time. And then that leads us right into Ruth chapter 1. And so with this attitude and this mindset and people doing exactly what they want to do, you can maybe understand why Elimelech would want to move his family away from this. There is a famine in the land, and so they're going out of there. Now, that doesn't take away that God said don't. He said don't go to Moab. Stay away from these people. We'll look at that a little bit more in just a second. But again, as everyone else was doing at that time, they did what was right in their own eyes. Elimelech did what was right in his own eyes, and he disobeyed God in doing that. And because of that, we see that Moab marriages became part of what we see in this story, at least. Again, they were forbidden, but that didn't stop them from doing what they wanted to do. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, we see that God said there was going to be punishments for those who disobeyed Him and went and turned to these foreign women. In verse 3 of Deuteronomy 23, it says, "No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord." So there was some pretty strict consequences for these people. Again, they didn't view worship to God like some worship or view it today. That was what they looked forward to. And sometimes that's not what we look forward to, even though it should be. But that was a big deal. No, you're not going to keep me from going to worship. And they wanted to do that, and even though sometimes they turned their worship into something that wasn't pleasing to God, that was a severe consequence to them. As you look at 1 Kings chapter 11, we see that Moabite women were part of the problem with Solomon. Begin reading with me in verse 1 of 1 Kings 11, if you've got it open there. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, "You shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away from their gods," or after their gods, rather. And Solomon held fast to these in love. So Solomon did what God said don't do, and what happened is exactly what God said was going to happen. You listen to these people, you go to these people, they're going to turn you away. And Solomon, in all of his wisdom, still followed exactly what he shouldn't have been doing. When you look at Ezra chapter 9, we see that Ezra was appalled because these people would not turn away. They wouldn't leave their Moabite wives. They stuck with them. Notice what he says there in verse 1 of Ezra chapter 9. So now when these things had been completed, the princes approached me saying, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the land according to their abominations. Those of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, and the Moabites, the Egyptians and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has intermingled with the peoples in the land. Indeed, the hand of the priests and the rulers have been foremost in this unfaithfulness. And when I heard about this matter, I tore my garment and my robe and pulled some of the hair from my head and my beard and sat down appalled. Then everyone who trembled at the words of God of Israel on account of the unfaithfulness of the exiles gathered to me, and I sat appalled until the evening prayer." Again, this intermarrying with these pagans, with these Moabites, was an abomination. He couldn't believe it. It was just detestable for him to do that. But that's exactly what we see happening here with Kilion and Mahlon, or however you say his name. That's what they were turning to. This was every man doing what was right in their own eyes. Again, you can see this throughout many books in the Old Testament. Nehemiah was very upset about some of the things that happened whenever they turned to the Ashdodites because of what they had done wrong. But anyway, we see that this wickedness, this evil, is what caused the famine in the first place. When you look over at Deuteronomy chapter 28, go ahead and turn over there. There are several passages I want to read there. But you can see the curses that God gave to His people if they did not obey Him. And famine was one of the main ones, and that's what really hurt them terribly. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning of verse 15, it says, "But it shall come about, if you will not obey the Lord your God, to observe and to do all His commandments and His statutes, which I charge you today, that all of these curses shall come upon you and overtake you." Okay, and so I'll just pick out a few of those things it says. In verse 17, it says, "Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl." Verse 24, "The Lord will smite you with the consumption and with fever and with inflammation and with fiery heat and with the sword and with blight and with mildew. And they shall pursue you until you perish." Verse 23, "And the heaven which is over your head shall be bronze, and the earth which is under you iron. The Lord will make the rain for your land powder and dust. From heaven it shall come down on you until you are destroyed." Basically he's saying there, the heavens are going to be so hard, there's not going to be any water that comes down. The ground is going to be so hard that no fruit's going to come up. You're going to be in a famine if you don't obey me, every commandment and every statute which I give to you. And so that's what we see is happening here. Again, why did Elimelech move his family? To get away from all of this? Well, he's out of the fire and into the firing pan, or vice versa. That's kind of what he did there. And maybe that's the reason why he and his sons died. We're not told specifically why they died, but when you see the wickedness that they had done, and the consequences that God gave upon His people, I don't think it's too far-fetched of an idea to think that that may be why he and his sons died, because they're all doing exactly what God told them not to do. Now, as we look back at verse 2, I want to keep something in mind. It says that they were Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. And y'all may have covered this in your class before I got here, I'm not sure. But if not, I wanted to talk about that. It says here the family is identified as those. And it points in there in Judah, after that Ephrathites of Bethlehem. Look over at Micah chapter 5. There are two different Bethlehems. And that may not, again, it's not something we think about. The only Bethlehem we think about is the one where Christ was born in. But in Micah chapter 2, notice what it says there. It says, "But as for you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, too much or too little to be among the clans of Judah. From you one will go forth for me to be the ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity." Okay, so what he's saying is here is he's putting a specific point down there on the map. He's not just saying Bethlehem, because that could have meant, you know, the Bethlehem in Galilee, Bethlehem in Judea or Judah. He's saying this is the specific one. And by the way, this is where Christ is going to be coming from himself. You little town, this is great things are going to be happening here through that. So again, it's an interesting thing just to see a little tidbit of where Christ is going to be coming from. It's not just, it doesn't just show up right there whenever Christ is born. But that's what he's talking about here. This is where they are at. So we can see a little bit closer there. Genesis chapter 35 and verse 19, this also says that's where Rachel was heading whenever she died. She was headed towards this same Bethlehem Ephrathah. And sometimes you'll see it depending on your version and depending on where it fits in the Bible. Some of them are referred to as Ephrath, some of them are Ephrathah, and different things like that. It's all talking about the same place as far as everything that I can see here. But anyway, there's just a side little note there to help us see a little closer where we're at. All right, but then as you look in verses 3 through 5, we see it explains the losses that Naomi faces. And again, that just kind of sets up for us. She lost her husband. And then the next 10 years, she lost both of her sons. That had to be just unbearable for all that to happen so fast. Sometimes it's really weird, but somebody pointed out to me that death happens in threes so many times. Someone died, then someone else that you know's family member died, then someone else. It just happens together, but all three of these happened to the same lady. Again, it's in 10 years, but still, that's a lot to lose all at one point. But I want us to keep in mind here that how we deal with these situations is all based on our attitude. We are going to respond in a certain way based on the way our attitude is in that. And so keep that in mind, because Naomi's going to deal with this in the wrong attitude, and obviously Ruth is going to handle it in the right way. All right, let's continue on with verse 6. Verse 6, we see they have this opportunity now to return to Judah. It says there, "Now she arose with her daughters," that's Naomi, "rose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return to the land, or from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food." So again, this is that same cycle we read about in Judah. God's people turn back to him, he favors them again. And so the famine is over here. Verse 7, "So she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each of you to her father, to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband.' Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, 'No, but we will surely return with you to your people.' But Naomi said, 'Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they're grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you. For the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me.' And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, 'Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.'" And then we'll see here in the next passage there in verse 16 where she picks up and she says that she's going to stay and don't tell me to go away. But again, like I said, this is just continuing that thing. They have an opportunity to go back to where she's from. It says a lot about both Naomi, but also of her daughters-in-law. One, that they wanted to go with her. They weren't bound to do that. But they wanted to go. And she has to tell them, no, I love you enough. I don't want you to lose the rest of your life having to be connected to me. Go back to your home. Go find you a new husband. I'm useless to you. Even if I was married today, I can't have a child. Are you going to wait that long if I did? No, go find happiness in your own home. And so she sends him back. But I think it's interesting. We kind of, or at least in my mind, Orpah, and I'm sure I'm going to call her Oprah by the time that we get done with this lesson. But Orpah, she always gets the bad rap. She's the daughter-in-law who didn't go. The one who wouldn't go. It's not that she wouldn't go. We see that she was already on her way. But Naomi convinced her to go, and she said, okay, I'll go. Ruth is the one that followed all the way through with it, but I don't think that's any kind of discount over Orpah. I think she still had the right attitude and the right heart in that. Again, they all weeped together whenever all this was happening. So anyway, but we know that God had a specific plan for Ruth, and so we see His will being done through these things. All right, as we continue in verse 16, let's get into the love of Ruth. Again, this lesson is really the love of Ruth versus the bitterness of Naomi. So let's look at the love of Ruth. In verse 16, it says, "But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me.' And when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her." Ruth's statement of love for Naomi right here is one that it's one that shows several things. This is one that many people use it in their marriage ceremony. It's a beautiful thing. Where you go, I'll go. Where you die, I will die. I'm going to be with you for the long haul. And so it shows some commitment. Again, this is the same kind of commitment that God wants for us in a godly marriage. That same kind of love, that same kind of commitment. It also shows an abandonment of all of Ruth's past loyalties. She's leaving her home. She's leaving her friends and she's already left many of them, and leaving her God. She's leaving everything behind to go with Naomi. Again, that says a whole lot about Naomi, but it also shows her character, her willingness to do that. Again, she left her God and went to serve the real God. That would make her a proselyte, one who leaves and converts from one religion to another. This is kind of like she'd be very similar to the Ethiopian eunuch, one who left all and changed all of his customs to be following the one God. And so that's what she's doing. She's not just giving up a little bit. She's giving up everything. Yes, she's still a foreigner. She's still a Gentile. But she was willing to leave it all to come and worship God and to be with Ruth. And so, again, that shows a lot of things. She acknowledges that there is a God. She is aware of that, and she even says there in verse 17 that I will be accountable to God for this promise that I'm making to you. And so, again, that says a lot about her. But it should also remind us, again, that we have a responsibility as well. God hears our promises. God sees all that we do, including with our marriage vows and things like that. So I want us to stop and think about a couple things, make a little application here about our commitment and our devotion. First off, to our spouse, when we made these vows, are we keeping the vows that we made? You remember how you felt whenever you met your spouse? The way that you felt in the first days of your marriage, the way that you waited on them hand and foot, and you did all these things, and you overlooked all their shortcomings. Do you have that same commitment and devotion to your spouse today? I know so many times we use that phrase, the honeymoon's over, and real life kicks in there. But is it over? Do we have the commitment, the devotion that we should have, till death do us part? Or do we go, we're done, I got the ring, I'm locked in, we're good? It's very easy to have that kind of attitude. But we don't need to have that. What about our devotion, our commitment when it comes to our family members? And let me say real quick, this portion of this sermon I wrote about a year and a half ago. A lot has changed in that year and a half. I was not here. We were living in another state, different people, different things, all this. But so when I say this, it has nothing to do with current situations, but it's something for us all to think about. But this is what I wrote when I was writing this section of it here. Are we committed and devoted to helping our family members in need? I said, what about the widows and the widowers in your family? Would you take care of your in-laws? We have some here that are doing that. We have some that may soon be doing that. Or years down the line may be doing that. Would you be willing to do that? But put ourselves in Ruth's shoes. What if your spouse died? Would you still take care of their parents? That's a test of love right there, isn't it? And commitment and devotion and all that. Would you be willing to do that? But what if we were in Naomi's position? Would our son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, and whatever take care of us? Would they be willing to do that? Would they be that committed and devoted to us because of the love that they had for your child? Would they do that or not? We have a thing, you know, many times when you think about in-laws, they're referred to as outlaws because there's no relationship there. There's no love lost between all of that. But when you look at Naomi and you look at Ruth, wow, what devotion, what commitment to do that, to follow and leave everything you knew for someone who's not even blood related to you. That says a whole lot, like I've already said, about both of them. But do we have that devotion, that commitment to our physical family as we ought to? But what about our spiritual family? Do we have that kind of love and commitment and devotion to one another, that they know that regardless of what's going on in their life, we will be there for them till death do us part? Do they know that? Or is it just something that we say? And as soon as we leave, there's nothing else that happens there. You know, we got to evaluate that and see if we really have that love and devotion and commitment that we ought to have. That's the kind of those things that Ruth had. So we can learn from that, and we can learn those lessons and apply those lessons to our lives and evaluate what kind of people we really are. But again, this lesson is not just about the love of Ruth. Let's look at verse 13 and let's start looking at the bitterness of Naomi. I think that may be even more of a problem today, is not handling things right. And whenever turmoil and things come upon us, what kind of attitude do we? Who do we put the blame on whenever something goes wrong? In verse 13, Naomi tells Orpah and Ruth, says, "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me." She's just saying, this is God's fault. All these things that happened are God's fault. In verse 19, as they're coming into Judah, she says, so they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came about when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. So do not call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me." So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of harvest, or barley harvest. And Naomi didn't live up to her name. The name Naomi means pleasant, and Mara means bitter. And that's what she's saying. Don't call me pleasant anymore. You call me bitter, because God has done all these things to me. She wasn't just bitter at life. She was bitter at God all the way. And you know, that's a low. That's a deep low that many face in this life. When things just don't look like they can get any worse, somebody kicks you in the back from behind. And you just go, "I don't know how I can overcome this. This must be God. How could God do this? How could He take this child? How could God do this?" How many times have we heard that? People want to find somewhere to put the blame, so it's easy just to throw it on God. That's the most ridiculous and dangerous place that we could possibly put that. But notice again there what she says in verse 20, the end of verse 20, the accusations that she gives. She doesn't just lightly put it there. She makes sure everyone understands exactly where her anger lies. "The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me." Excuse me. "The Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has witnessed against me. The Almighty has afflicted me." Is there any doubt where her bitterness was? It was right there. It wasn't, well, my husband left and went to a place where we shouldn't have gone. My sons went and married people that God said very clearly not to do, not to marry. She didn't take the blame and say, yes, this is the result of our wickedness. God did this. And how many times do we do that? We do something, and I'm not saying about blaming God for it, but we do something foolish. We do something that we know is wrong, and instead of taking the blame and saying, yep, I own that, I did it wrong, we say, well, if they hadn't done that, this wouldn't happen to me. You know, we get into an argument with our spouse and say, well, I wouldn't have said that if you hadn't have said this. And no, neither side wants to admit and say, you know what, we both have the wrong attitude. We have bitterness inside of us, and so we're going to blame it on someone else. But that's what happens so many times. Again, this is about a woman and her daughter-in-law and all this, but what does it mean to me? This is not just old people writing things to nobody. They're talking to us, and we can learn lessons from that, and specifically in this case, about bitterness. Compare that to what we see in Job. There in Job 1 and verse 22, after his herds have died, his servants have died, his own children have died, he blamed everything on God, didn't he? Well, no, he didn't do that at all. Verse 22, through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Why? Because he wasn't bitter. Because he had the right attitude. Yes, he hurt. He was suffering because of the things he did, but he had the right attitude. He didn't blame it on God. He wanted to talk to God. He wanted to see what he could do to ease his pain. That's the attitude that we need to have, not the one that we see there in Naomi. But notice what else she did. She didn't just blame God. She took the credit for all the good that God had done. You see there in verse 21, I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. How did she get full in the first place? She thinks she did it. That's not how it happened at all. And that's what bitterness does to us sometimes. It helps us, or it keeps us from recognizing where our blessings come from. From recognizing that, yes, God has done this. He has blessed us in all these things. You know, and I think that's one thing that we struggle with sometimes. We don't recognize readily, this is a blessing. This is God who has blessed me in this situation. And I think that's where a lot of people that are of the liberal institutional side have it much better than we do. Many of them are very quick to say, yes, what a blessing. Thank God for that. But we don't want to say thank God because that sounds wrong. And so many people have taken God's name and they've flipped it all over the place, and it, you know, there's something to that as well. But we should not live our lives based on how other people make us feel or whatever. God blessed us, thank God. We are so blessed, and we need to acknowledge where it came from. Don't say, well, I did this. It's very easy to do that. When we give our money in the collection plate, well, this is what I earned this week. No. This is the job that God blessed you with, and this money that God blessed you with, and you're going to give Him back His own money. That's the attitude that we need to do of that, and that'll help us to give in a more giving and loving, generous way. But anyway, let's get back off that one. But I think we understand where we're going with that. Again, as we compare that again to Job, he didn't have this attitude of I at all. In verse 21, the verse right before we just read there, when all of these things happened, again, he didn't blame God, but what did he say in verse 21? Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He recognized where his blessings came from. He understood that God could give them, and he could take them away. We just need to be good stewards of those things while we have them. But the irony of this whole thing is, did Naomi come back empty at all? No. She had a daughter-in-law that treated her like a daughter would. One that was willing to do all the things we talked about already. To give up all these things. She was willing to do that. Freely, happily, she did that. She came back with something greater than probably she had. I mean, looking at the character of her sons and her husband, I think she got the better end of the deal there. But again, that's neither here nor there. But she had something great, and she had no reason to be saying that God did this, to have the bitterness towards God and say that He is the one that is against her. And so for the last few minutes here, I want us to look at God's plan in suffering. Again, so many times people want to blame God, like we already talked about. Turn over to Romans chapter 8. You might want to put a marker here. I want to read several verses here. Paul does a good job of reminding us about what we have to endure, but also what we are going to be blessed with because of our enduring. And again, keeping our priorities straight as far as what we're really here for. In verse 18 of Romans chapter 8, Paul reminds them that, you know, heaven's going to be greater than anything else. Doesn't matter what you're going to face, heaven is better. He says there in verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." Do you believe that? Do you believe that there's no comparison? And it's kind of goes back to Phil's invitation the other day. You know, I'm not even going to try to say it because I know that I'll butcher it terribly. But again, if we're living righteously, basically heaven's the best thing we've got to look forward to. I mean, earth is the best thing to look forward to. But if we're living righteously, this is the worst we're going to face. Heaven is uncomparable to what we have to look forward to. And we can turn and look in Revelation and read about the imagery that is described to us about the beauty and the street of gold and the pearl gates. And, you know, obviously that's a physical representation of a spiritual thing, but it's trying just to let us get a glimpse of, you can't imagine it. It's there. It's a promise. God is going to fulfill His promises. Don't even try to get hooked up with the things in this life that you think are good, because that's trash. That's waste compared to what you've got. But so many people get bought out so cheaply. And we need to make sure that we don't get bought out in there. But we also have to understand that God isn't out there to get us. He's not out there trying to do all the things that Naomi accused Him of doing. He wants us to do what's right. He wants to reward us. In verse 28, again, still in Romans chapter 8, we see this. "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. For whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren, in whom He predestined. That these He also called, in whom He called, these He also justified, in whom He justified, these He also glorified." Again, God wants all of us to become His children. He wants every one of us to do that. That's why He was willing to send His Son. You can look at verses 15 and 23. Talk about how He sent His Son to adopt us, to give us that hope of heaven, of salvation, of heaven, the greatest thing we could ever imagine. He did that so that we can live the way we should on earth and then be glorified with Him in heaven. Again, God makes all things work together to accomplish His goal, as it said there in verse 28. But again, it doesn't matter what we go through in this life. We are going to have heartbreaks. We're going to have trials. We're going to have temptations and things that try to tear us down. But if enduring those things helps us one bit to be more like Christ, and it helps us one bit to be closer to heaven, isn't it all worth it? Aren't the temptations, the trials, the heartaches, and all those things worth it if it helps us get to that greatest reward ever? Certainly it is. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And I'll go ahead and tell you, you can go ahead and look at Romans 8, 31, 32, and also in verses 38 and 39. And you can look at that the great blessings that come through there. But I want to look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12 as we close. And I want us to see how Paul responded to his infirmities. Respond to the trials in his life. That thorn in the flesh. He responded in a good way because he knew that was going to help him to be able to be who God wanted him to be. Beginning of verse 7. It says, "And because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I entreated the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And He said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weakness and with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul understood the importance of these different things, these trials and these horrible things in life. Life is cruel. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to choose to react like Naomi did and be bitter and blame God and blame others for all of our problems? Or are we going to say, you know what, this is a trial for me. I'm going to look even harder towards heaven. My hope is going to be increased because I know this isn't here. This isn't it. This isn't what life is about. And I know, again, it all goes back to invitations here. Larry's invitation of the day. You know, we got something to look forward to. Something that is better, and that's what I want. I want to be there. I want to be in a place where there is no sadness. There's no pain. There's no agony. All that's over with because I'm in the greatest place of all. Again, look at those other things. Sorry, I've got a warning here. I don't want to restart. Okay. Again, I want us to read this last passage as we go. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 14 and 15. Remembering that bitterness is something that's going to cost us our soul if that's what we can't get out. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 14, it says, "Pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many are defiled." How many people are going to lose their soul because of bitterness? Just a little bit of bitterness that they didn't take care of, a little root that wasn't plucked out, and therefore it started to grow. Here it says, many will be defiled because of that bitterness. And let us not ever fall into that same thing. Let us not let that be named about us, but let's rather look towards Ruth. Let's look and imitate the same things that she did, the love, the devotion, the commitment to God and to one another that she showed towards her mother-in-law. I appreciate your attention. Go and get your song books out to the invitation song. Again, Lord willing, we'll pick up this chapter 2 next Sunday morning. As you look at yourself this morning, we've got a time purpose for us to examine our souls, to examine where we're going to be in eternity. There in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 52, we're told that Christ's return will be in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. I've thought about that several times. You know, I've thought in years past going, what if that was it? What if before I could snap, Christ came back? Does that scare you that that's your eternity? Based on the way that you're living right now, based on your obedience to God's word or your lack thereof, based on your love and commitment, based on your bitterness, is that a good eternity or is that eternal punishment? The wonderful thing about times like this, and it's open at all times, but we have a time set aside. If you look at your life and you say, you know what? I am not what I need to be. I do see error in my life. I see that I'm weak. I've not been obedient in baptism. We have no hope if that's where we're at. It's a sad, sad thing. It's a scary thing. And if pride or whatever is keeping us from changing our life, from being obedient in whatever aspect it is, why? Why would you choose to live your life with no hope? I hope if you fit into that situation this morning, that you'll do something about it. Don't wait. The opportunity is now. If we can help you in any way, come as we stand and sing.
Bring Christ, you broken love.